Hello, and welcome to the reading of Time magazine. I'm Alan Corbett, volunteer reader for Virginia Voice, and today we're going to be reading from the April 22nd issue of Time, and we're going to start with this large article entitled Time Earth Awards 2024. From the fashion runway to the rainforest, this year's honorees are using their influence to demonstrate leadership in shaping a more sustainable future. And we're going to start with Jane Fonda. Every generation must join the fight, and this is written by Stephanie Zakarik for Time magazine. Jane Fonda, at 86, is small-boned and elegant, her eyes like soft blue-gray flannel. Yet it's startling how much energy shoots through her via a simple handshake. If a woodland creature could shake your hand, it might feel like this: the will of an entire forest ecosystem pouring through one being. She's physically strong, sitting up straight and tall for more than an hour on a backless ottoman, perched before a cozy sitting room fireplace in her Los Angeles townhouse. But the message telegraphed by her handshake is less a matter of muscle tone than of pure urgency. If you could put it into words, it would be this: there's not much time left. Fonda has already lived many lives. The daughter of a much-loved actor and socialite, Henry Fonda, and Francis Ford Seymour, she has built an astonishing acting career herself. In the space of just a few years, she shifted from the campy delights of Barbarella to career-defining performances in Clute and They Don't Shoot Horses, Do They? Younger audiences know her from the book club movies and the hit TV series Grace and Frankie. And although it's now common for actors to support causes they care about, vocally and financially, Fonda is the OG actor-activist. In the early 1970s, she supported Native American causes and spoke out on behalf of the Black Panthers. She fought for civil rights and issues directly affecting women's welfare, though she may be best known for her anti-Vietnam War stance in the 1970s. In particular, a photograph of her perched on an anti-aircraft gun taken during a 1972 trip to Hanoi. Fonda has apologized repeatedly and profusely over the years for that photo, knowing how hurtful it was to GIs and veterans. She knows what it's like to be embattled and to go to battle for principles she believes in. But in 2019, Fonda has a breakthrough that, as she describes it, was bigger than any revelation she'd had in decades of both acting and activism. She felt a growing sense of alarm a year earlier during the 2018 California wildfires. "The skies here were orange-brown," she recalls. "I read that birds were dropping dead out of the sky over New Mexico and Arizona. They couldn't make their normal migratory journey over the coast because of the wildfires. So they were flying over the deserts, and they were dying of dehydration and hunger." Fonda spent her early years in the hills of California in the 1940s when there were no freeways and no smog. She remembers the sound of meadowlarks, nightingales, and mourning doves. You don't hear them anymore. I went into a downward spiral. I realize it's happening now. This isn't something in the future. I've marched and I protested, but given my platform, I'm not doing what I can do, and this could be the end. I have to commit myself more. Fonda's resolve intensified when the galleys for Naomi Klein's 2019 Green New Deal manifesto, On Fire, landed on her doorstep just as she was heading off to Big Sur for Labor Day weekend. She was so shaken by Klein's book that she immediately called Annie Leonard, then head of Greenpeace in USA. This was not a cause, says Fonda. This was not a specific war in a specific place, or a specific group of people fighting for rights. This was human civilization we're talking about. I just realized it in the core of my body. This is the moment I have to completely show up with everything I have. We're the first generation to experience the climate crisis, she says, and we're the last that can do anything about it. I want to be part of the generation that does something about it, because this is it. Feelings of despair are understandable in the face of imminent climate disaster, but they can also be a retreat, a means of leaving the hard work of change-making to someone else. It's not in Fonda's nature to feel that kind of helplessness. I've never despaired before. I'm not a despairing person. But not even she knew exactly what she ought to be doing, which is why she called Leonard, who promptly set up a call with Klein, climate activist Bill McKibben, and environmental lawyer Jay Halfen. I wanted to raise a ruckus, Fonda says. So, together, the group came up with the idea of planning an act of civil disobedience every Friday, inspired by protests like Randall Robinson's 1980s anti-apartheid sit-ins outside the South African embassy, as well as by the actions of Friday for the Future. The youth movements organized by Greta Thunberg in 2018 as well. Young people, Fonda says, were asking for us. They were saying, we didn't create this crisis, but it's our future that's going to be destroyed. Where are the older people to join us? So I said, I'm here. I volunteer. The first Fire Day drill, Friday, was held on October 11, 2019, with Fonda appearing on the steps of the Capitol in a black and white houndstooth newsboy cap and a three-alarm red coat. Only about 50 people showed up to hear the speakers and experts who had been scheduled to appear, though that number would swell in the coming weeks. Fonda was arrested that day. Photos show her holding her zip-tied wrists high, a badge of honor. And although this wasn't her first arrest, she had been arrested once in 1970 at the behest of the Nixon White House on suspicion of drug possession, and several times by military police during anti-Vietnam War protests. It was the first time, though, that she had been detained for civil disobedience. She would be arrested a total of 5 times, spending one night in jail, according to the 14 Fire Drill Friday protests held in D.C. through January 10, 2020. The pandemic forced Fire Drill Fridays to move its protests and educational sessions online. And though the last virtual event was held on January 5th, the movement's momentum continues. One thing Fonda learned from the experience is that Americans do care about climate issues. Data collected by the Yale Program on Climate Change Communications in autumn 2023 show that an estimated 72% of Americans believe climate change is happening, and some 70% believe it will harm plants and animals as well as future generations of humans. The whole point, Fonda says, is to let people know they're needed. As attendance at Fire Drill Fridays grew, it was Fonda says, mostly older women who showed up, women who'd never been to a rally before. When people are asked why they haven't taken any action in response to the climate crisis, the answer, Fonda says, is often simply that nobody asked them. So I say the great unasked is our target. Let's turn that concern into action. When you spend an hour or two with a person who cares passionately about a particular issue, their idealism tends to fill the air, sometimes to the point of crowding out the human being sitting in front of you. This is even true, at least somewhat, of Fonda. Not because there's anything recessive about her, but because her mission seems to have set every molecule of her being ablaze. She's the same Jane Fonda we think we all know, and yet more. She speaks of how the climate crisis affects women more negatively than men, particularly in the global South. She makes a brief reference to her own recent cancer diagnosis. She was treated for non-Hodgkin lymphoma in 2022 and is now in remission, as a springboard to talk about the prevalence of cancer in communities located near refineries and oil wells and fracking facilities, not to mention the fossil fuel pollution that surrounds us all. She speaks with urgency about the upcoming election, whose outcome could determine the fate of the planet. In 2022, she and a small board of advisors established the Jane Fonda Climate PAC to help elect climate champions, particularly down ballot, where she says the robust work on climate is happening. Mayors, city councils, boards of supervisors, county executives are the people that can create a whole climate plan, make it more resilient in your city or community. The Political Action Committee is already in high gear for this year's elections. Candidates are begging for its endorsement, and Fonda says they go through a rigorous vetting process, and they are absolutely cannot take money from the fossil fuel industry. This is probably the most important election. The problem is we say this is all the time. Only this time, it just so happens to be true. Who gets elected in the United States in November is going to greatly determine whether there's a future. But even Fonda, whose passion and commitment are so exemplary, is more than just the sum of the issues she cares about. In her book, What Can I Do? My Path from Climate Despair to Action, she writes of being in that jail cell, wondering what the late Tom Hayden, a brilliant activist and one of her three ex-husbands, would think of her. He was a great strategist. How would he advise her and her compatriots to proceed? In the next paragraph, though, she wonders if she would have the nerve to move to D.C. and launch a project as ambitious as Fire Drill Fridays, if Hayden were still alive. When I asked her about this moment of self-questioning, she replies more mischievously than evasively, "Did I say that? And then she elaborates. I was in awe of Tom. His intellect, the depth of his understanding of what needed to happen and how to make it happen. I was always kind of in the student role with him. And I don't think he respected me very much, or at least he made me feel that I was stupid. And so I think he would have probably tried to talk me out of it. Or I would have been afraid that he wouldn't have approved. The point of this story isn't to paint self-doubt as a weakness, but to show how getting behind it is often what pushes any of us to leap further and higher than we ever thought we could go. I guess one of the reasons I'm so involved is I'm 86 years old. I have a feeling that people can say, look at what she's doing at her age. If she can do it, I can do it. The first step out of despair is simply showing up. We've already had brief moments last year when global average temperatures surpassed the 1.5 degree Celsius temperature increase that scientists say we must avoid, she says. But we can go back again. We can reduce it. It's going to require incredibly brave and bold actions. And we can be brave and bold. And that was Jane Fonda. Every generation must join the fight. And this was written by Stephanie Zacharek for Time Magazine. The next Earth Awards honoree is Robert D. Bullard, writes to the next Environmental Justice Leaders. I am a proud boomer and Vietnam Marine Corps veteran. I am also an environmental justice fighter. When I began this work in 1979, environmental justice was just a footnote. Through our efforts, it is now a headline. But these days, millennials, Generation X, Generation Y, and Generation Z combined far outnumber my generation, so we must equip future generations with the tools and resources to take our plight across the finish line to build climate-resilient communities. Environmental justice embraces the principle that all communities are entitled to equal protection and equal enforcement, along with access to housing, transportation, food security, water, health, and clean energy. Everyone deserves to live in pollution-free neighborhoods where kids can play outside and on playgrounds that chemical plants and landfills do not surround. It is heartening to see so many young people and students working on these critical issues without the wedges that would have previously driven us apart. Environmentalism is now seen across the disciples, across the discipline, through this intergenerational movement. Anyone can be part of it, and everyone's skills are needed. One does not need to be an expert to join. Mentors, centers, and networks always look for young minds, volunteers, and innovators from all academic areas, from public health to graphic design, reducing environmental, health, economic, and racial disparities remains a priority of the environmental justice movement. We must continue this work with the next generations, with science, with data, and with people who understand we do not need false solutions. By gathering community-level air monitoring data, for example, local advocacy groups petitioned the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality for regular pollution monitoring. But having data, science, and facts is not enough. We must marry this information with action to make transformative and lasting change. And to solve many environmental problems, we must also solve inequality issues. Avoiding, for example, placing industrial facilities in low-wealth communities of color in the first place. More importantly, we cannot continue without righteous investments that support the communities most in need. This includes the Justice 40 Initiative, which in 2021 formalized President Biden's commitment to make environmental justice a part of tackling climate change. It directs federal agencies to work with states and local communities to deliver on the administration's promise that at least 40% of the overall benefits from federal climate and clean air energy investments go to disadvantaged communities. Many progressive social movements that have been successful in the U.S. had young people and students pushing hard at the front. This includes the civil rights movement, peace and justice, women's rights, anti-war movements, and now environmental justice. We are powerful and unstoppable when we work together. The quest for environmental justice is an ongoing marathon relay. You run your 26.2 miles, and then the next generation begin their leg of the race. I am driven by, and I am happy to be able to pass the baton to, the up-and-coming generations of environmental justice advocates who will continue with the same resilience that so many involved in the journey have already shown. In this next era, my hope is for policy and action to be swift. Climate change does not have 40 more years to wait. Young people, you are valued. I want to see you in the rooms involved in the global discussions of change and policy with the opportunity to share the stories of the environmental and climate impacts on our communities. Let us continue to work together and learn from each other so that money can follow need and not power. And this was Robert D. Bulliard, who is a distinguished professor of urban planning and environmental policy at Texas Southern University. And this was written for Time Magazine. Our next environmental honoree is Gabriella Hearst, Sustainable Fashion as the Ultimate Luxury. and this is written by Katie Lang. When Gabriella Hearst launched her namesake brand in 2015, one of the pillars of her design was a resolute commitment to sustainability. It was a decision that came in the wake of a clarion call from her past. Following the death of her father in 2011, the fashion designer inherited Santa Isabel, her family's 17,000-acre ranch, where she grew up in Paysandú, Uruguay. Revisiting her remote childhood home reminded Hearst how they made their own blankets and furniture, drawing on precious resources from the ranch to construct pieces that would last, a stark contrast to the waste-filled practices of the fashion industry where she had been working for more than a decade. I started to see the discrepancy between what I was doing in New York and what I was taking care of in Uruguay, she said. That's when I started being very concerned about climate change. In the 9 years since she founded her label, Hearst has helped redefine her industry, making the case that knowing where clothing materials come from and who crafts them is the truest form of luxury. Her designs, which favor sleek silhouettes, expert tailoring, and meticulous craftsmanship, have become wardrobe staples for the thinking woman. She counts Angelina Jolie, Greta Thunberg, and Jill Biden, who once wore one of her dresses to the 2020 presidential inauguration, as being among her fans. In addition to heading up Gabrielle Hearst, she also served from 2020 to 2023 as the creative director of the French brand Chloe, where she helped become the first European luxury fashion house to receive a B Corp certification. But while Hearst's profile has risen, her mission remains the same: to create beautiful clothing with care and entice people to join the climate fight. They have the desire for beauty, so I have to bring conscientiousness to the product, she says. You can't deny the catastrophes that are constantly happening worldwide that are climate related. It's here, and it's happening, and we're all going to pay a price. Every step of Hearst's design process is an opportunity to honor climate commitment. She breathes new life into the remnants of Turkish rugs and cashmere scraps, which are reincarnated as colorful overcoats and sharp blazers. Her handbags have a waiting list, not because of desire for exclusivity, but because she makes them in limited quantities or to order, which helps curtail waste. In 2019, she produced the first carbon-neutral runway show and announced her brand was plastic-free for both front and back of house. She's also refreshingly unconcerned with having her customers buying more. I'm very happy with my clients just finding one good sweater, she says. I grew up with that kind of mentality on the farm. If it's good quality, it will last you for years. So we wanted to have a product that was well-designed and timeless, using the nicest materials in the world and making it at the highest level. But Hearst's vision for a more sustainable future extends beyond fashion. She's a vocal advocate for developing nuclear fusion dedicating her Chloe Spring / Summer 23 collection to the clean energy solution. She believes her advocacy is as vital to her brand as its more creative aspect. "Your legacy is your value system," she says. "We know that we're going to be one of the brands of the future. I am willing to put it in the time and dedication because I can see the long-term view. I know exactly where we are going." And that was Gabriella Hearst, Sustainable Fashion as the Ultimate Luxury. And this was written by Katie Lang for Time Magazine. Our next honoree is probably somebody you've never heard of, but it is Nemonte Nkwimo. And on respecting the Amazon and what is owed to the planet. Someone recently asked me why it's important to protect the Amazon rainforest from oil drilling. The question made me angry. Can you imagine being questioned about the importance of protecting your home from being destroyed in a fire? Or how about protecting your home, your extended family's homes, and all your people's homes from demolition? Can you imagine being asked, why is it important to protect your country from nuclear devastation? Those questions seem absurd only when you take into existence of your home and your people for granted. Western civilization has always taken the destruction of my home and my people for granted. And now, this well-meaning question assumes that I must offer a defense of my existence. It also presents a false innocence about the asker's complicity in the continued destruction of my home. As a Waiorani leader, tasked with communicating beyond our territorial borders to safeguard our land, I often face questions like this. Answering is part of the resistance, and it is not easy. Yet, with Ecuador's government now pushing to ignore our hard-won ban on oil drilling in one of our most biodiverse forests, it remains an urgent question to answer. What I long for, and what the Amazon and Mother Earth demand, can be summed up in what is missing in the questions and policies so often pointed at me and my people. Respect. Why is it so important to protect the Amazon rainforest from oil drilling? We Waiorani like to walk. When we need to think, we head off walking in the forest. When we want to express our emotions, we walk and sing. Our songs, too, are fruits of the forest. Wherever we walk, we are in communication with everything around us. We know the plants and the birds in the way city dwellers know the names of streets and the logos of stores. But streets do not breathe, and stores do not take flight. The forest is our grocer, our pharmacy, our hardware store, our theater, our gym, our park. We cultivate our small orchards and walk the forest to hunt and to gather food, medicine, tools, beauty, and art supplies. Politicians and oil executives think that we are idiots, that we plod among the trees, picking things up that look yummy. They say that we don't even know the value of the resources beneath the ground. But that is how they show their own ignorance. The oil deep in the earth is the blood of our ancestors, and we know better than to dig up a grave. Why pillage a grave when life is all around us? We don't need oil. The forest itself is life. We know which plants can heal and which songs to sing to ask permission for cutting them and using their cures. We know that the Petomo palm fruits in January and February, and that its oil is excellent for maintaining long, shiny hair and healthy skin. We know that the monkeys and the tapirs time their reproductive cycles to coincide with fruit abundance. We know that the peach palms make the best spears. We know not to use more than we need. The first Europeans to enter the Amazon wanted only gold and power. They brought disease and murder. It is no wonder that all their tales of adventure describe the forest as a site of danger. I have had dreams of great dangers to come. Unrestrained industrialization has poisoned the atmosphere. Burning down the Amazon will accelerate climate change beyond a point of no return. Uncontrolled warming will imperil life on Earth. Mother Earth will not be saved. She does not need you or anyone to save her. She demands respect, and she will punish humanity for failing to give it. And yet, time and again, people in positions of governmental and industrial power refuse to do so. They insist on destruction. They've had so many opportunities to respect us, and they have squandered them all. Just in recent years, Ecuador's political class could have upheld indigenous people's rights to free, prior, and informed consent, the right to decide what happens in their territories, as enshrined by international law, by the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples. But they didn't. They made us fight. In 2019, my people achieved a historic legal victory, protecting 500,000 acres of Waiorani territory, and setting a legal precedent to protect millions more. The government could have respected that court victory and complied with the ruling. But instead, it has failed to respect it and continues to have its eye on drilling oil from our lands. They could have respected our demand to stop all oil drilling and pumping in Yasuni National Park, one of the most biodiverse places in the world. But they didn't. Again, they made us fight, this time joined by allies across the country. Just last year, the people of Ecuador again made history by voting in a national referendum to stop and permanently ban all oil exploration in Yasuni. We won. We should be celebrating and coordinating with people in other regions and other countries to help devise strategies to protect their forests. But instead, we are forced to keep fighting. newly elected Ecuadorian president Daniel Noboa, has called for an illegitimate moratorium on complying with the results of the referendum. Why can't they respect us? Why can't they even respect their own laws? How many times do we have to use the tools of civilization that wants to destroy its courts and its elections to stop their destruction? Where is the rule of law when the rulers change the laws whenever they feel really so much to ask for respect? I often feel heartbroken when I travel abroad to speak about our struggle. I see how many possessions and luxuries people have and how they only want more. Their greed fuels the burning of the Amazon. Some people on those trips tell me I'm a hero. No, I'm not. I'm just trying to do something. This is resistance. Why is it important to protect the Amazon from oil exploration? My life, the lives of my family and people, our homes, our culture, our language, the lives of myriad plant and animal species, many of which are endemic to the Amazon, the life of the forest itself, and the lives of millions of people, perhaps even yours, all depend on it. Is that good enough? And Nanquimo is co-founder of SIBO Alliance and Amazon Frontlines, and is a Waorani leader who has won the Goldman Environmental Prize and a co-author of an upcoming book. And that was Nimonte Nanquimo for Time Magazine. The next article is going to be coming from the Time Off section of Time Magazine, and this is about the Fog of War, written by Andrew R. Chow for Time Magazine. When the author Viet Thanh Nguyen was growing up in California as a refugee from the Vietnam War, depictions of that conflict were omnipresent in American culture. Platoon, Apocalypse Now, Full Metal Jacket, and many other films portrayed American heroes fighting their way through a dystopian backwater and then dealing with the psychotic toll of defeat back home. Very few of those films gave much thought to the experiences of the Vietnamese, who themselves refer to the conflict as the American War. It's been 51 years since the last American combat troops departed Vietnam. Nguyen now teaches a class on the war at the University of Southern California and finds that most of his students, who were born after 2000, haven't seen those movies. But their perspective and themes linger in the air, irrevocably molding the collective memory. Hollywood has so radically shaped the global understanding of this war and its aftermath, Nguyen says. Nguyen offers a counter-narrative with The Sympathizer, his Pulitzer Prize-winning 2015 novel that follows a North Vietnamese spy during and after the war. Now, that book is getting the Hollywood treatment, a miniseries adaption premiering on HBO on April 14th. The A24 production features a mix of stars, including Robert Downey Jr., Sandra Oh, and John Cho, and ethnically Vietnamese newcomers, most notably Hoa Xuan, and the lead role, Nguyen, who is an executive producer, and the creative team that hope the series will force viewers to center the Vietnamese perspective of the conflict while rethinking fundamental American myths, including how the country still wields its geopolitical power in a fractured world today. Everything that the United States was doing in 1975 are things that are still happening now, Nguyen says. The Sympathizer tells the story of a half-Vietnamese, half-French communist agent who infiltrates the South Vietnamese military and then embeds in California after the war, hoping to sniff out gestating plots upon his homeland. The novel could hardly have been better received. It won the Pulitzer for fiction and landed on over 30 of the best of 2015 lists for its biting wit and ambitious shifts in tone, from thriller to screenplay to satire. But Nguyen, who is now 53, harbored even grander dreams for his debut novel. A successful novel might sell tens or hundreds of thousands of copies, but even a bad television series or bad movie could reach millions of people, he said. Hollywood didn't immediately understand his vision. Nguyen says that in early meetings, producers were uneasy about his insistence that the show center Vietnamese people speaking Vietnamese. But the tone shifted following the political unrest during the Trump era and the murders of George Floyd in 2020 and of six Asian American women in Atlanta in 2021. Hollywood's liberalism was challenged, Nguyen says. It took a while for the people with the capacity to make this kind of thing to catch up. The adaptation was further boosted by the sign-on of co-showrunner Park Chan-wook, the revered South Korean filmmaker behind Old Boy and The Handmaiden, who read The Sympathizer and understood how it connected to his own country's history. As in Vietnam, Korea endured a proxy war between the U.S. and the USSR. South Korean soldiers fought alongside Americans and the South Vietnamese in Vietnam. Their involvement in the war spurred an American economic injection that propelled the South Korean economy toward becoming the juggernaut that it is today. Nguyen was thrilled by Park's involvement, as The Sympathizer was inspired by Old Boy in its darkly funny exploration of violence, memory, and revenge. Park, in turn, recognized a kindred spirit. The way he went about using humor in such an absurd and dire situation, that was very, very much my style, Park said through a translator. Nguyen displayed his dark humor one day on set during the filming of a movie within a movie that sketches Hollywood's one-dimensional depiction of the war. Nguyen asked to be cast as a nameless Vietnamese villager who gets blown up by the inner movie's American heroes, as a symbol for how casually Hollywood treated mangled Asian bodies. I just thought it would be appropriate for the author to be killed, Nguyen told me wryly. Instead, he was inserted into the show as a photographer at a party. The adaptation is fairly faithful to the novel. Park and his co-showrunner, Don McKellar, punched up the spy element, making Swande's protagonist, referred to only as the captain, into more of a noir action hero. That tweak meant that while the character is by no means an angel, he is slightly less brutal than in the novel. a scene in which he wields homophobic tactics to force a confession, was altered, for example. If you make him like Steve McQueen, he's going to be very charming and sexy, McKellar says. It wasn't to soften him. It just felt natural that in the visual medium, we had to lean into the movie star appeal more. Another key decision that Park made was to have several of the white American characters, a congressman, a filmmaker, a professor, a CIA agent, be played by one single actor. Park hoped to drive home a conceit central to the sympathizer, that imperialist systems of power are entwined and overlapping. Park's top choice was Robert Downey Jr., who agreed to take on the multifaceted challenge and serve as an executive producer with his wife, Susan Downey, under the banner of their production company, Team Downey. Downey Jr.'s presence also added a meta layer of meaning. Many viewers, especially younger ones, know him best as Iron Man, who Marvel's Stan Lee envisioned as the quintessential capitalist, a billionaire fighting communism and supplying arms to the U.S. military. Iron Man was first introduced in a 1963 comic, fighting in Vietnam alongside Americans against the racist character, Wong Chu, the Red Guerrilla tyrant. But Nguyen and Park make clear that the sympathizer is neither pro-North Vietnam nor anti-American. Some of the novel's searing condemnations are aimed at the Vietnamese government, which led to roadblocks in getting the book published in the country. Nguyen says, McKellar said they tried hard to film in Vietnam, sending hundreds of letters to the censor board, but did not get permission. They ended up using Thailand as a substitute. I expect that the Vietnamese government will be pretty unhappy, McKellar says. While the sympathizer spares no faction from criticism, both the book and series also harbor overt ideological aims. Nguyen is something of a progressive firebrand on social media and in public speaking appearances, and doesn't hide his political goals for the show. Chief among these is challenging audiences to reckon with the corrosive global effects of American power and racism. There's a general allergy to this idea that literature or art can have any didactic or political functions, he says. I think that's wrong. Nguyen hopes the show will reveal the war's place in American history and its relevance to conflicts still unfolding today. Americans want to understand their wars as discrete things, Nguyen says, but if we're talking about these wars in Asia, what we're really talking about is an extension of America's campaign from its very earliest settlements to continue expanding westward, all the way to China. It's all part of the same history. That history, Nguyen argues, extends to the U.S. support for Israel's prolonged assault on Gaza. In October, a week after Hamas's attack on Israel, Nguyen signed a letter criticizing Israel's retaliatory attack on Gaza. The Manhattan venue 92 NY pulled Nguyen from a book talk promoting his memoir, A Man of Two Faces. Nguyen says that despite potential repercussions, he was inspired by Martin Luther King Jr., who stumped against the Vietnam War and its deadly Western arrogance in 1967. Nguyen penned his foreword to a reprint of that speech this year. Here was a man who extended his principles from the cause of black liberation to the cause of being against American imperialism. And what he saw is a racist war in Asia and in Vietnam, Nguyen says. I see Israel's war as an opportunity in the same way for moral and political clarity. Nguyen also risked drawing the ire of the right-wing ideologues who might dismiss the sympathizer as an epitome of a liberal Hollywood indoctrination campaign and of Hollywood itself, which promises greater representation and creative freedom after a 2020 but has become increasingly cautious in a moment of corporate consolidation. I think the show is quite provocative in ways that are pretty unusual in American popular culture, says McKellar. I keep wondering if HBO understands exactly the landmines that they are walking through here. First and foremost, the sympathizer aims to succeed as a work of art. The thrill via its haphazard assassination attempts, clandestine romances, and games of cat and mouse. But Nguyen also hopes it stirs uncomfortable introspection and helps shift long-standing narratives. It's gonna be unsettling, he says, but it's worth the risk if it could be a lever to affect the mass understanding of the war and its impact on the Vietnamese people. And that was The Fog of War, written by Andrew Chow for Time magazine. By request, we are going to reread an article from last week, just briefly. From the brief section, we did how to respond to an insult according to therapists. And here are the five responses that you might want to remember. Hey, flag on the play. Or, could you repeat that? I don't think I heard you correctly. Or, what a wild thing to say out loud. Or, you should come with a warning label. Or, I don't get it. Can you explain that joke? And those were five non-nasty responses that might help you later on in life. But now, we have come to the end of our time. And so, this was the reading of Time Magazine for April 22nd, 2024. And I am Alan Corbett, volunteer reader for Virginia Voice. And as always, we thank you all so much for listening.